Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 390 of the podcast. And it's Friday, 24th of August, 2018, as I record this. So today I have an interview with my mum. And I'm kind of excited and also terrified to share this interview with you because I think it's lovely and I'm really proud of my mum and what we've done together as Penny Appleton. But also she says a few things which are like, oh no. But, you know, I know you guys, we're amongst friends, right? So you guys will just say nice supportive things. And, you know, my mum just has not got out there on the internet. So this is her first thing. And part of the reason we had a sort of secret pen name for ages was because she didn't want her face to be online or her voice certainly or anything. So this is a pretty big deal. It has some funny parts of the interview. I hope you also find it useful because we talk about what mum learned as a first time author writing, she's written 4 books now. And also, I guess, starting later in life. And we talk a bit about our family history. And I hope you find it useful and also interesting. In publishing news, Rakuten Kobo finally arrives in Walmart, which is very exciting. With ebooks and audiobooks, I have an ebook in the Walmart opening month sale, so we'll see how that goes. From an article in Publishing Perspectives, touting 6 million ebooks and a $9.99 audiobook subscription, the new Walmart partnership with Rakuten Kobo gives the Canadian retailer what it hasn't had in the US market so far: brand recognition. And this is interesting, of course. So this, and they've got a screenshot. Obviously, I'm not in America, so I can't see this. If you are in America, you could, I guess, go down to Walmart and have a look. But this is interesting because the brand recognition side, the name Kobo, of course, should be well known in the writer community, certainly on this podcast, because they're a sponsor and we talk about them quite a lot. But in terms of readers in America, I think this is interesting, especially as there are some other rumours about, you know, what's happening with Nook. You know, seriously, what is happening with Nook? So, you know, could Kobo give Amazon a run for its money? I don't know. Possibly. They certainly do in other countries. But this will give American ebook readers and audiobook listeners a new option. I think this is really interesting. We shall see. It might not. It might not work. It might work very well. I don't know. I don't shop at Walmart, but obviously a lot of Americans do. So I'm fascinated by that. I think it's going to be interesting to see what's going on in a year's time. But that has certainly started now. Another interesting thing is that BookBub have introduced featured new releases. Now, this is really interesting because for many people, BookBub featured deals are much easier to get when your book is an older book, because it's easier to get a BookBub if you have lots of reviews. Now, if you don't have reviews, then most of us have been using the BookBub ads, which is not the featured deal. It's like a pay-per-click ads for new releases. So that's something we have been doing. But now they've introduced this featured new releases. And, you know, they're saying this is one of the toughest challenges book marketers face is new release promotions. It looks like it says curated lists hand-selected by our editorial team, targeted by category. Each featured book will reach US members subscribed to a single BookBub category. So this does look as if it's a very small thing at the moment, but to me, it, it introduces a new possibility of marketing new books. Also, for a while now, BookBub has had subscriptions, so people can kind of subscribe to your, or whatever they say, like or add you, whatever, as a favorite on BookBub, follow you on BookBub, that's it. And then basically they'll get notified when you add a new book. So slowly BookBub is kind of becoming more than just an ad platform. So this new release thing, I think, is a good idea, because it is difficult to promote new releases if you don't have an email list, if you want to get the word out. And in fact, even if you do have an email list, most of us will send an email, we'll also run ads, we'll also mention it on podcasts and videos and whatever. So you need that multiple touches. So that's interesting. BookBub's featured new releases. And then the other thing I wanted to mention, which off the back of the Karen Inglis podcast about children's books, which was a couple of weeks ago now, this was a post on CNN Money with the headline, "Alexa, play my kid a podcast. Parents look for screen time alternatives." And I thought this was brilliant because, you know, my sisters, I have nieces, we have six nieces now between us. And, all you hear is we want to reduce screen time. And because people have devices in their homes now, playing audio, I mean, obviously you can play music, you can play kids' music, you can play audiobooks, but podcasts, are also another possibility for children's authors in terms of marketing potential. So yeah, I think this is a really interesting idea. It will, there's more and more concern about screen time for kids. I think this might be interesting for those of you who write for children. And with the kid-friendly smart speakers that have all these settings and things on, you can presumably find some podcasts. But I think it will be it's probably very early in this market, as in there might be podcasts aimed at children's authors, and there are obviously lots of podcasts aimed at parents, but for children specifically, this might be a good way to get into it. So that's on CNN Money. Now, as ever, I link to everything I talk about in the show notes. So remember, you can always get those at thecreativepen.com/podcast. And this is episode 390. So yeah, we're almost heading towards 400. We're always there. Okay, so in futurist stuff, right? Oh my goodness, this is fascinating. So thank you to Jeff Adams from the Big Gay Fiction podcast, which has to be one of the best podcast titles ever. So Jeff sent me this piece from Fast Company, and then that piece links into a blog post at Christie's. So Christie's is, you know, when someone says Christie's to a British person, we think very, very rich people buying very, very expensive pieces of art, as in they only touch quality. Christie's is a hallmark of quality in the art scene. Now, this article, okay, I'll just read the headline. Christie's will auction an AI-generated portrait created by the French collective Obvious. Now, this is, and what I think is different, because there's nothing particularly new about AI creating some art. We've talked about that before. Yes, AI can create art and humans can't tell. But this is, and we've talked about that with music. We've talked about that the writing side is interesting, but I think we're getting close. This is really interesting. It's created by a two-part algorithm. On one side is the generator, on the other side, the discriminator. We fed the system with a data set of 15,000 portraits painted between the 14th century to the 20th. The generator made a new image based on the set, and then the discriminator tries to spot the difference between a human-made image and one created by the generator. The aim is to fool the discriminator into thinking the new images are real-life portraits. Then we have a result. So this, to me, is the point of difference. This is split into two different algorithms, or two different processes, where one is just making loads and loads and loads of images, and the other one is saying whether or not this is a real image or an AI created image. And after being fed all of these portraits. So this one that they've created, and you know, you've got to go have a look at it. I will again link to it in the show notes, or just have a look at christies.com AI portrait or Fast Company. And okay, you'll look at it and you'll go, that's not very good. But the point is, if you walk through any of the great art galleries of Europe, that would not stand out. Seriously, I'm not particularly into portrait painting. They are not the galleries I tend to hang out in, but I've walked through quite a lot of them in Europe. And I would not even give this one a second glance, in that I would not say, oh my goodness, that's so awful. I expect that to be AI. Really fascinating. They're saying the portrait is estimated to sell between $7,000 and $10,000, and the money will go towards furthering the algorithm. Now, this is also Christie's specialist, Richard Lloyd, who's organising the sale, said, it may not have been painted by a man in a powdered wig, but it is exactly the kind of artwork we have been selling for 250 years. Now, that quote there is the point to me, because this is the thing. I believe this is what readers will say about writing. It may not have been written by a starving author in a garret, but it is exactly the kind of work I've been reading all my life. Seriously, I don't believe there's any difference. So this is another reason why I think what we talked about with Christine Catherine Rush last week, this is why it's so important, because I believe that personal branding and our author voice is the only way we are going to hold on to readers for a lifetime of creative work. It has to be a part of you that goes out into the world. And I've joked before on this show about whether you would be able to tell if I was using a voice synth AI. And these things will be, they're around right now, and they will be coming into the mainstream, no doubt, quite soon. But yeah, I mean, this is fascinating to me. I love this two-part AI. To me, that's actually the type of thing, and when I don't worry about AI, you probably know that by now, but I think that I will be collaborating with an AI as a tool as soon as I can. In fact, you could say I did this morning when I wrote a scene based on in San Francisco, where I have actually been, and in the Columbarium, which is an awesome place with loads of human remains. The type of place I tend to find in cities I visit. And I was writing about it, and obviously I was Googling stuff about the architecture, about the various symbolism of the place, and reminding myself of things that I had seen in person. So I was collaborating, you could say, with Google, with, you know, I was looking on Google Maps. I saw how long it would take me to get from the Mission District to the Columbarium. You know, I was using a tool to help me write better. And that's how I see AI. That's why I think this generator versus discriminator idea is really interesting, because in a way it's similar to our creative voice and our editing voice. I love it. Anyway, this delighted me. So thank you, Jeff. I really enjoyed that, and hope you guys enjoyed that too. And we'll go and have a look at the picture. If you're into portraits, maybe you'll have a better informed opinion than me. Right, my personal update. I guess I talked a bit there about the scene I was writing this morning, but I'm up over 50,000 words. I'm into the final few scenes. I'm in San Francisco, in I guess what I'm calling the Valley of Dry Bones, and yeah, really enjoying looking at my pictures of that San Francisco trip. And also glad I knew when I was in that Columbarium that I would be writing about it, so I did take a lot of pictures of even small details so that I could make the writing as rich as possible. I mean, obviously you can always find pictures online of things, but sometimes you get some really good tiny details, just if you're actually physically in a place, stuff that you can put in that makes your writing more real. And yeah, I took a lot of pictures of the names of the people who were there, and just some lovely stuff. So I'm looking forward to sharing that in Valley of Dry Bones. Also, interestingly enough, so I've mentioned that I did manage to get some really good dictation sessions in, And I think the dictation, I haven't been dictating this week at all. And I think it's because I needed that dictation to kind of power through the saggy middle when I knew what was happening, but I was not, you know, that I'd done the discovery. I knew what was happening. I was just getting into getting the words down. And now I'm kind of back into feeling my way towards the final moments. And I kind of know how it's going to happen. But with my writing, I often find more stuff as I go. I imagine most of us do. And so I'm back to typing. And so I think it's interesting with dictation. I seem to only be able to dictate if I know what's going to happen. Whereas if I am truly discovery writing, then I need to type because almost the dictation is too fast for my story brain. So that is a really interesting thing to note with my own dictation process. But I was so glad to have it, to have some really big word count days based on dictation that I would then go through and add in more depth later. So yeah, that's fun. Just finishing that. Also useful stuff. Tim Leffel, who is a travel writer of 20 years has been travel writing, and he's coming on the podcast actually in a few weeks to talk about travel writing and how you can make a living doing that. But he's got a guest post on the blog that just went up today actually as I speak, and I wanted to talk about it because it's really a good article, and it would be because Tim is a very experienced freelance writer. But it's called Writing for Now, Soon and the Future. And this headline puts the nail on the head. What is it? Like bangs the nail on the head, whatever the gets it right. And essentially what he's saying is, look, if you're doing whatever you're doing to make money right now, you also have to think about the midterm and the long term. So for example, if you're doing a day job, are you writing things for later on? If you're a freelance writer that's bringing you cash next month, well, what about next year? What about 10 years time? I'm really looking at finding a balance between immediate cash flow and the sort of building intellectual property assets for the longer term. And this is so important, I think, in the writing space. And this almost inability sometimes to see the future that I think so many authors get obsessed about, their sort of daily sales ranking and their monthly income right this minute. So what you kind of have to see is, okay, look, this is fine. Like right now, I'm going to get this series done. I'm going to get it out there. I'm going to make some money now. But what you also have to think is, all right, well, how can I still make money from those intellectual property assets in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, 20 years' time? I think this is fascinating. So I wanted to kind of mention it so that you maybe can go and have a look at the blog post. Again, I'll link to it in the show notes. And also to really consider in your life, in your income streams, what have you got for immediate cash flow? And that might be the day job. What have you got for the sort of medium term? And what are you building for that long-term focus in terms of intellectual property and that longer term income that will help you later on? And maybe you're in KU and you're like, I'm just going to rake it in right now and I'm going to put some of that money into investments. That might be another way, or, you know, whatever you're doing. But yeah, I wanted to just mention that because I think sometimes we forget this sort of three-stage process: writing for now, writing for soon, and writing for the future. So thanks for all your emails and tweets. You can always tweet me at The Creative Pen with a double N, and or leave a comment on the blog post, the show notes. So Beth Underwood says, I so enjoyed this podcast, ladies. As a fellow all over the mapper, this one spoke right to me. Appreciate the suggestions and guidance. That was about the podcast with Chris Rush last week. Lisa M. Lilly also says, love this podcast on brand loyalty, especially appreciated the distinctions between the author, a particular series, and a specific book. These are the things we do need to think about. And definitely, you know, the branding, you can make decisions now, but often the things we do for branding do last a long time. They do last into the future. SJ Pajonas said, this is a really great episode and I just purchased Chris's branding book. So I hope to learn more. I actually feel like I have a good grasp of my brand now, but I can always improve. Also, I hear more and more about people moving to Las Vegas. It seems to be the in place for people with a mobile business. I think that, Chris didn't mention it, but I have heard other people talk. I think there's also some tax benefits of being in that area. So, you know, when you have a business, there are ways that by moving, you can actually lower some of your basic costs. Don't quote me on that, but I have heard that from some other people. So, final one, I did just want to mention Julie Carno said about the interview with Michael Brent Collings on depression. She said, out of all the podcasts I've listened to about writing, this one is my all-time favourite. The way Michael Brent talks about depression and how it feels gave me an idea of how to describe it to my husband. It also allowed me to feel okay about not wanting to write when I love to. Really, really pleased that that helped you. And that episode with Michael Brent continues to spark conversation. And again, so important for us all to acknowledge mental health issues. Chris last week talked about her physical issues, and we've had some other comments about other people with chronic illness. And writing is one of these things we can do whatever our situation is. But again, if you build for the long term, that will help if you have either mental health or physical health issues where you need to take a break. Very cool. Thanks, everyone. And I always love to hear from you. So let me know what you're doing while you're listening to the show, or anything you particularly learned. So today's show is sponsored by my own audiobooks. And if you didn't know, yes, I have lots of audiobooks for authors. So you can find lots more information and hopefully inspiration. I have How to Write Nonfiction is out. How to Market a Book, third edition. The Healthy Writer, also available. Good idea as we come into the fall. Business for Authors, I narrated myself. So that is the only one I've narrated myself so far. The Successful Author Mindset and How to Make a Living with Your Writing are all available as audiobooks on Audible and iTunes. And also my fiction books. If you like fiction, if you like thrillers, I have a few box sets. I have the Arcane Book 1-3. And also the London Psychic series is in a box set, which is very good value for your Audible credit. And also the books are all available individually. Now, before I move on from the audio, I've been thinking about how I can use audio for my fiction. And I really wanted to start another podcast, but I just can't do it. That just doesn't fit with my refocusing idea. Yes, I want to refocus on JF Penn as my brand, but I do not want to start another thing as big as a podcast. But what I'm thinking of is actually reading my own fiction. And it's funny because I said a couple of years ago now that I would never narrate another audiobook because of how much work it is. But now, because I have the wonderful Dan helping me with the podcast, and I'm right now in my walk-in cupboard, which we are going to pimp out with some audio stuff, I am going to start with reading some short stories, and then I might even be doing whole novels, depending. And I won't be doing voices. So there are some authors who do just a straight read, which is they don't make up different voices for different things. But I'm really thinking about this at the moment. So if you have any thoughts, obviously you guys must like listening to my voice because you listen to the podcast. But if you have any thoughts on audio for fiction, as in read by the author, I would love to know. I personally have listened to books by Scott Sigler, and he does a straight read. He does kind of voices, but not really. Like, he's not an actor, but he's been doing his own fiction audio for years as podcasts first. So these are some things I'm thinking of, but I think audio is so powerful. And a lot of people keep asking me when Map of Shadows is going to be available as an audiobook, and I just haven't done it because it just hasn't been worth the investment. But now I'm thinking, maybe I'll do this as a brand thing. Anyway, those are some things I'm thinking about. So I'd love to know what you think. Tweet me at thecreativepen or email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com. Right, so thanks to everyone supporting the show on Patreon. Thanks to new patrons, Stephen K. Smith, Joseph Mello, Miles Payne, Patricia at Authors Love Readers podcast, and to Mike Allison for increasing his pledge. I really do appreciate your support on Patreon. It demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And you can give just a couple of dollars a month and or a couple of coffees a month if you'd like to, and you'll get the extra monthly Q&A audio. And I also put up extra audio during the week as well. So lots of audio fun, and you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, let's get into the interview with my mum. Today, I'm here with Jackie Penn, who is my mum. Hi, mum.
Hi, Jo. Thank you very much for inviting me to come on your podcast. It's your podcast, isn't it?
It is, yes. It is indeed.
Podcast.
So we're obviously, this is a bit weird for both of us today, but it's going to be really interesting, I think, for everybody. So just a little introduction before we get into the interview. So Jackie, my mum, worked as a teacher before moving into change management consultancy, working with Hewlett-Packard Company in Idaho, Oregon, and California in the USA, as well as Europe and the Middle East. After retirement, Jackie renovated houses in New Zealand before moving back to the UK in 2011. And we have now co-written three books, three sweet romance novels as Penny Appleton. And here is one of the books, Love Second Time Around. And today we're also, I mean, we're going to talk about this today, but we are now stopping writing novels together as Penny Appleton. So we're going to talk a lot about what we've learned. And also because mum is a new writer, so she's going to share her thoughts on all of that. So this is going to be brilliant. So mum, we get, you know, easy question to start with, because I know people are going to be wondering, like, you've had a great career, you could just be swanning around the world doing what you like, but you've started again, you're writing. So what do you love about writing? What is it that has kept you already going for four books, because you've done a non-fiction as well? What are the fun parts for you? Why do this?
Gosh, I think it's because I love learning and the fun of working with you on doing something like this. You've been going a long time now and you've made a great success of it. And I love the books that you've done. And also there's a nice feeling of when you actually hold your book in your hand. That first one that you showed there, The Love Second Time Around, it was the nice feeling of taking stories from my past, because they're actually based on me, all three of them, and my experiences, and seeing them come alive in a book, and then having you help me make them into something you can be proud of, really. That was a very nice thing to do. But I do enjoy learning, and though I am retired from my other jobs, I think it keeps your brain alive to take on some challenges. And also I'm an introvert, so I much prefer to write, and I've journaled all my life. So really writing was a very comfortable thing to do. And the fun was seeing it move from the written word on a page, you know, because I write by hand, to seeing it become a book. That was a magic thing.
Yeah, but I guess I have a question as well. So why do you think you didn't do this before? Why do you think, you know, because like it seems to me, having seen you go through this, that you are a natural writer, that actually that's what you should have been doing. And you did drama at university a long time ago. So you have that storytelling side of you. So what do you think are some of the things that might have stopped you writing before?
I think it was because of drama and teaching. You put a huge amount of your creativity into teaching and facilitating young people to express themselves. I did a lot of production of plays, producing plays. So my creativity was going into that, really, that the kids I worked with were writing. they were doing GCSE and O levels, and my job was to help them to write creatively. So I didn't write them. The other thing was I was bringing you and your brother up.
As a single mum, we should say.
And that's a very busy job. If you're working full time and then you've got two children who bring homework home and, you know, need to be taken to basketball and stuff like that, you don't have much time to write. And I've also been a painter. So my creativity went into painting. And I think the last thing was that this was your thing. You became a writer and you were making your way in the world and in indie publishing. And it was like, well, keep your nose out on Joe's patch for a bit. You can go and do loads of other things. But then when you became successful, then I wasn't challenging you. You've become the expert who's coached me. That's what's been so exciting. Then you're going to talk about family doing stuff together in a minute, but that's been a very unique thing for me, Joe, is not to be the mum and the parent and the teacher, but actually to be the learner. So I think I didn't write because I was doing drama, because I was teaching, because I was bringing up youngsters, but I always have written a diary, but that's not really publishable to anyone else.
No. But it's interesting. I think, you know, you've always been a reader, so you've always read lots, and we've always had books in the house. So I was always brought up with books. And but what was funny, and I don't know if you remember this, I think, well, we've talked about it since, but when I wrote one of my first books and you read it and you said, why don't you write something nice like Hilary Mantel? You remember that?
I think, yes, that's the sort of mother saying, why don't you get a proper job?
But then what was so, what was really great for me was when you actually said, once you were writing, you were like, oh, this is hard. So you had this kind of renewed respect for what it meant. So, and that was surprising for you, I think, wasn't it? You were surprised by how hard it was.
It was, because Rod, your brother, said, oh, well, you've been an English teacher, it's going to be easy for you. And I said, no, this is a whole different ball game. It's partly, if you look at traditional publishing, you actually start with a story and then an editor takes it. And then if they like it, they tell you thousands of things you have to change. And then there's loads of people get input into it. But when you're doing indie publishing like you are, there's a whole range of professionalisms you have to learn, don't you? So you see the whole process from the time you write the story through to analysing who is your audience, how much is it going to cost to actually get it out there, who are you publishing it with, and then how do you market it? It's a whole different world. So writing a story in your English class, your fiction class, is very different from actually publishing it and saying, and I think you made the distinction. You asked me, do you want to write this so you can see your name on a book, so that you can say, I wrote this book, you know? And I said, no, I don't actually want to see my name on it, just in case it's rubbish. So the first one was written under Jay Ryman, wasn't it? Because being Jackie, I was often called Jay, the letter J. And then as I was walking past Ryman's, the stationer's down in Bristol, I thought, that's a nice name. So I wrote the funeral book, the first one, the nonfiction, under Jay Ryman, to close off a particular aspect of being a funeral.
Celebrant.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And then when we looked at Penny Appleton, we looked at a whole different thing, didn't we? If it was going to be a sweet romance, what would the names be and things? So you said, do I want just to have this book as for pleasure, or do I want to try and make a commercial success of it? And I said, well, I've really loved doing the painting. I don't know if you remember this, but nobody ever bought them.
Or a few people did, but it wasn't exactly, it cost you money. It was a hobby.
You look at the cost of paint and canvases. I got great pleasure out of it, but actually it's very expensive, you know. And then when I retired, I thought, I can't afford to do this much anymore. So with the books, I thought, we'd love to write, but wouldn't it be fabulous if they were good enough for somebody else to buy as well? So That's what it was about, really. And no, I didn't want to see my name on the book.
And you're still not going to use your name. I guess we'll come to that in a minute. But I do want to just circle back on the English teaching, because I actually think, that English literature, studying English literature, can actually hold back the storytelling. Do you think that?
I do, yes. If you look at one of my favourite books and particularly movies, is Pride and Prejudice. But actually you read Jane Austen's style and it's completely stultifying for the 21st century. Much easier to see it in film than it is now to study Jane Austen. Or Dickens. I mean, look at Dickens' stories are fabulous, but you wouldn't look at his language and his writing now because it's not relevant. So you're, with writing today, you're looking at, well, people reading today are very different. They want it faster. They want it in little chunks. You can't have great big long paragraphs of description because it's got to be much more visual. So I actually think, yes, the study of some English literature is, I think you can, I used to teach story writing and use bits of classical writers and also Tolkien and people like that. But yeah, I think it can be, if it's taught in a way that says you've got to write like this, it doesn't help.
And I guess what are any of the other things that you, that surprised you about writing the novels particularly? Because I think the nonfiction, you know, you were a consultant, you know how to write a document, and nonfiction, you wrote a document, we edited it, it came out. And for everyone listening, that is How to Plan a Funeral by Jay Ryman. And it's an excellent book if you, if you need to plan a funeral. Everyone needs this. Oh, there it is. How to Plan a Funeral. And it is super useful book, but there's a big difference between here's everything I know about how to plan a funeral, which you wrote. Obviously, we had a death in the family and you studied that. But a novel is completely different. So what else surprised you about the novel?
I think if we looked at all three, what surprised me was you want it to be handleable. So you're not just looking at the novel itself, but focusing on the reader rather than the author. So if you remember rightly, my first version of Love Second Time Around was 90,000 words. And you said, not bad, Mum, there's some gems amongst the rubbish.
I don't think I ever said rubbish.
You said, there's some gems amongst the crap, Mother. I think you actually put it in writing. But it's 90,000 words, you've got to cut 40,000 words out. And I kind of went, my baby. I just sweated over writing that. And she wants me to cut it in half. And so that was a good learning that you, if you want a book that's going to be that thick, like J.K. Rowling, then you're going to have to maybe hit a market that you know will take that. But for our my kind of books, the kind of novel, the sweet novel, romance, someone wants to get into bed and read a chapter and then be hooked into saying, let's read another chapter before I go to sleep. Oh, well, I would like to read another chapter. And they eat it like a bag of chips or, you know, a bar of chocolate. And at the end, they put it down and they go, that was great. I really enjoyed that. So there's a whole different way of writing the novel than, as you say, the non-fiction, really. And then your genre. So what was fun about working with you again was you used to send me loads of books, kind of like how to write a romance or how to structure your novel. Or I had one here that you, or this one helped a lot.
Oh, you have to hold it up a bit.
Sorry.
Oh, look, The Successful Author Mindset by your daughter, dedicated to my mum.
Really struggling, and you sent this, and it was lovely. I've written in the front. I've written this. I love this book, not just because Jo dedicated it to me, which is nice, but what she said, it really, really helped. So you can see lots of my corners are turned over.
Oh, where
it's dark, and then I go, well, Jo's been there. She's 10, 11 years now ahead of me on the journey. I'll go and see what she said about this. Oh, that's nice. So instead of phoning you, panic-stricken and miserable, like I used, and you say, just stop, Mum. Go and have a break. You know, go for a walk. Don't hit yourself anymore. I would go to that, and then you sent me two more. This is Character Arcs.
Oh, Creating Character Arcs by K.M. Weiland, isn't it?
Yep, and that helped me a lot with my characters. I never understood what you meant. I used to say, look at the arc of the character, I think, what is she talking about? And then this was really helpful. And then this is stunning, but probably still a bit too advanced for me.
This is the Story Grid by Sean Coyne. So for those of you on the audio, Mum is holding up the books that are good for her. And yeah, the Story Grid by the lovely Sean Coyne is about... It's really pretty hardcore, isn't it? But I think every time you read it, you can get something else from it.
I think this is for life, really. This is an encyclopedic knowledge of everything you need to know as a good editor. And as you start to write, if you think, well, I'm also editing my own work. And frankly, more effort and pain goes into the editing, or it did for me anyway. Does that happen with you?
Well, I think over time it changes, and what we found that, and I want to just circle back on the cutting down that first novel. I should just explain to people, like, part of the reason we did Penny Appleton is you said, I don't remember how it started, but you wrote a book and I had not even considered publishing with you. But then I read the book and I realized that there was a sweet romance in there. But it did need to be excavated a little. But when I read it, I was like, I could see this going out there. And the reviews have been amazing on Love Second Time Around. You know, it really is a mature romance, sweet romance, because you're my mum. There's just a kiss. That's it. You know, just so everybody knows, you just don't talk about other things with your mum.
Well, what was good was with sweet romance was I said to you, well, I'm 70 now, so I can't remember what sex was all about, and I can't write as 50 Shades of Grey. And you said, well, I wouldn't want to read it anyway, you know. And so I said, well, what else could you write? And you said, well, sweet romance stops at the bedroom door. It's about relationships. It's got a lot of affection and feelings in it, but it doesn't go into the graphic detail, you know. So there's a lot of readers who like that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And it's actually a very fast-growing niche. I also think that you did find the writing cathartic in a way. So Love, Home at Last, you know, you wrote about the death of your Bobby, your beloved Bobby dog. And I mean, that a very emotional scene, and I know it was hard for you. So how can writing help the cathartic emotional stuff for the writer?
Very much, Joe, actually, because I did write about, and I had a German Shepherd dog who I had for 12 years, and he had to be put down at the end. So he was all right, but his back legs collapsed. And I think any pet owner goes through that feeling of, I don't want him to suffer. Yeah, I can't bear to lose him. And when you hold your animal in your arms and they give them the injection and suddenly their spirit is gone, that was very tough for me. And like losing my mum and dad, you know, he really was a member of the family. So when I wrote about it the first time, it lifted the pain because I went through it again and I remembered, you know, I looked at all these photographs and I made him a photo book. But you said when I put it into Love, Home at Last, it's in that book there, you said when I write about my characters who have got dogs and horses and animals in their lives, the characters come alive because it's me talking. You hear me through the words. And I think you sent me a message saying you just read the bit where Bobby has to be put to sleep again and cried a second time, you know, they've got you the second time as well. So I think it, as a writer, it is a very cathartic thing. I think you call it emotional beats. Do you? You put an emotion in a particular part. It illuminates the character of the person you're talking about. It has a part in the action. It moves the story forward because in this book, Lizzie and Harry are united over the issues of animals and things. So yeah, very cathartic. Go on.
Yeah, I think, and that's what I've really enjoyed seeing. And I think one of, you know, let's talk now about the challenges of working together. So we are very good friends, as mother and daughter. And in many ways, we're similar. Like a lot of people would say, oh, our characters are quite similar. But I think what the writing has shown to me, because you've read some of my fiction and you have said before, I can't read this, I get nightmares. You know, I've given you, I feel like I've traumatized you over some things I've written. And now, and then I read what you've written, and it's, I actually think reading someone else's fiction is a very, is far more intimate than reading someone's nonfiction. What do you think?
Totally agree. When I first read your thrillers, I thought, who is this child? This doesn't belong to me, does it? Is this what I brought up? She's like Bram Stoker, my goodness. And you said something like, yes, but I put all that part of me, that alter ego, the black side of me, the dark side of me, into the books. And I thought, yeah, that's probably right, because in lots of ways, I'm just a wimp, you know, whereas you're very, very tough. And that's really admirable, you know. So, yeah, it does come out in different sorts of fiction, doesn't it? And I eventually could no longer read your books, you know, not because they're nasty, but because they made me, I couldn't get to sleep, you know. I'd be thinking, oh, Morgan's down in this cavern and it's full of skulls and
that's why they're called thrillers.
Yeah, that's right, but it's not my genre, you know,
and this is really let's just talk now about why we're stopping Penny Appleton, because this is the heart of it. I read the fourth book, which will come out at some other point under another name. And when I read that fourth book, I really had this real feeling that your voice has become stronger. So your individual writing voice is stronger now. You know what you're doing. And also, I feel like this is not my genre. Like what I was trying to change your book into was not the work. We are not natural co-writers together, and I was not acting as a good editor. And I said to you, I would not accept the comments that I'm trying to give you from an editor. Therefore, we can't do this anymore. And it was a tough discussion, right? But I think in some way you felt the same. You kind of understood that, right? So tell us, how was that for you? Like, how have you been feeling about that?
I was actually quite relieved. Because when you sent it back and said, well, there's some radical changes got to happen here, I actually thought it was the best piece of work I'd sent you so far. But because you are so experienced, it's almost like we've been on a tandem bicycle, and I've been so privileged to have you on the front guiding the bicycle and being able to pedal behind and learn so much. Joe, I've learned so much over the last 2 years. It's really been fabulous. I've said to friends, I can't believe that my daughter would give me this amount of time to help me grow and develop, because you're really a great coach and mentor to a lot of people, actually. You've been involved with helping a lot of writers grow, haven't you? But when it's actually a member of your family. So when we first started writing, I thought to myself, if Jo's going to put this time in, whatever she tells me, there's no arguing, no, oh, but I want to do it this way, because she'll just say, well, push off and do it. She hasn't got time, and it takes a lot of time editing someone's work. So the first book, you did a huge amount of work on to help me structure, to say this bit's good, but it needs to be here, and you need to put this bit here, and there's a bit here that's totally missing, and you're still missing your character tags. You know, this person arrives on the scene and I have no idea what they look like or where they are. So I'm still doing that. But in tandem, eventually I was beginning to think, well, you know, I should be writing on my own now, and I'm ready. Ride on my own. They've actually, I know as much as I, you've given me confidence to ride my own bicycle. and we ride two very different bicycles. So we've kind of been going along, and now you said to me, I might as well just rewrite this whole book if I'm going to do this. So it's time to stop. How much time you've taken out of your own writing to give me the confidence to say, I love doing this, I'm going to go on doing it, whether you're with me or not. I don't know what will happen with it, but I definitely think it's time to part ways now.
And it's been, like, I've learned a lot too. I think from when, like, as you say, I've been writing now, I started writing 12 years ago, and I've written a lot of books, and it becomes difficult to almost see what you know. And what I learned from, and we are officially co-writing, because we did co-write those three books. I wasn't just editing, we were really co-writing. And I learned a lot about almost what I know by doing that. And I actually ended up doing a course on how to write a novel, really based on what we were going through, because what I realized, and I know, like, for example, I sent you that story grid book quite early on, and it was too early to send you the story grid. I mean, like, you did a very good job of reading through it and then kind of going, okay, I'll just take a step back and look at some other things and then return to it. But that, I think I've learned a lot from that. But also I'm just thrilled because, you used to write poetry, right? A long time ago, maybe you still do, but I remember reading some of your poetry when I was maybe 15. Something like that.
Where did you find that?
Probably in a drawer. Yes. but I remember thinking, my mum's a writer, and I think that must have had some impact, as in I had in my mind that writers were a long way away, but you were an English teacher at the time, and we did have books around, and that, so that clearly made a big impact. But it's been so interesting to see, like, for example, the point of view thing. I know people will find this interesting, because I was like, you need to do a third person point of view, and it's almost like you couldn't understand that, because it was like a, until you understand it, you don't understand it. It's just a thing, right?
You asked me once, what books do I like most? And the odd thing is, I seem to like young adult work.
Yeah, you like young adult work.
The Twilight series and The Hunger Games, and they're written in first person point of view of the heroine. And I thought with my first book, it'd be nice, wouldn't it, to write it from the point of view of an older heroine. Sorry. So it's actually written from Maggie's point of view, and that's really my voice it started off with, and the stories that had happened with that older person. So we're writing from Maggie's point of view, and it's her view of Greg and her view of what happened. And then when you came in and co-wrote, you added a whole different depth to her that wasn't me, and you said it's time to go past autobiographical stuff and make it more relevant to other older readers as well, which was great. So the point, I thought, well, that's the point of view, isn't it? And you said, no, third person point of view written in the past makes it so much more flexible. And then in this fourth book, you said, I can't edit this, because you've now written it from two points of view. The female point of view is chapter one, and the second chapter is the male point of view. And I thought, this is fascinating. I'm doing a great piece of innovation here. I have it slung back at me and told
let's just be clear. In that, there are books where the first chapter is first person, second chapter is another person, both of them written in first person. But it's, again, because of the genre I come from, it's written in the third person with the name. Morgan was down the crypt with the skulls, and you write with the I. And I don't naturally write with the I voice, it's just the first person voice. So again, it's like a huge difference between us, just in the way we naturally write. And so I want everyone listening to really hear this, is that there is a natural way that you end up writing and what you prefer. And I think you feel that voice much more now.
Yes, but now that when you sent back this fourth book and said about the third person past tense point of view, I've rewritten the first three chapters in the way that you've suggested. And it does mean it's much more versatile. So where there's a bit that just doesn't work for David, and really it should be in chapter three, I can't easily move it without completely rewriting it. But at the time I was doing it, I thought I was being awfully sophisticated. Oh, this is such a cool way to do it. You know, it's most unusual. And it is most unusual, but I think you have to be almost like, you know, the level of the English patient writing, really, you know, and a very, very experienced and sophisticated writer could do this. But a newbie couldn't. So very good feedback.
Yeah, well, yeah, really interesting. Okay, so let's just move on to the family thing. So obviously, we love each other very much. We're friends, but we also drive each other quite crazy sometimes because we are quite similar. We're both strong women and, you know, and we can both be very strong. Let's just leave it at that. But what are some of the, if people, but I know, and I work with Jonathan, my husband, I've helped dad, and you're obviously, for everyone listening, my parents are divorced, but I helped my dad separately do a book. And you know, I've helped my, my niece in New Zealand do a book. And I have tried to help family members because we do that because we love people. Right. And, but there are challenges. So, and I, like, for example, I wouldn't do another book with my dad for very different reasons than working with you. You've been a dream, really. But what are some of the challenges or recommendations for people listening who want to help their mum, or they want to help their dad or their brothers and sisters or their love partners? You know, what are some of the ways you can balance love and also helping in a really practical way?
I think it's not so much about love as about respect. So and also establishing who's in the lead. So one person, say you're going to help your daughter or you're going to help your mum, then you have to set the ground rules up. The ground rules for you and I were, you were established as a writer and an indie publisher. I was a complete newbie, and I listened to what you had to say, and I had no experience in that field, so I just did everything that you said. And I didn't challenge you, I didn't turn around and say, no, well, I don't want to do it like that, because we had that respect. I respect you very much for what you do. So I think that's important, respect and setting some ground rules, and maybe a time limit or some definition, some boundaries as to what you're going to do. I think one of the reasons we have stopped now is also that I haven't been very well over the last 6 months or so. And being a professional writer, you work to deadlines, got to. So I've been unhappy because I haven't been able to keep up with the deadline. And I felt, now I need to let that go with Jo, because now I'm impacting on her business, really. So there's love, but there's also respect. And my respect for you said, it's time to do my own thing in my own time while I get well again, and to let Jo go now. And thank you very much indeed. So if you're working with a family member, I think it's respect, setting boundaries, and who is in the lead.
Mm. And I do like the metaphor of the tandem bicycle and then heading off on your own bicycles, because I think part of it is I do feel like you can go off on your own. Like, I have, you know, I'm going to help you with some of the technical side around the publishing, like I did with the funeral book, but it will be on your Amazon account. It, you know, it will be your bank account. That will still be your side of things, with the new book. So I feel that respect too, is that, you know, and, you know, I wouldn't have carried on or wouldn't have encouraged you so much if I didn't think you actually had something there.
Well, that was lovely too, really, was that I knew you wouldn't. If you said, well, that was good, Mum, first book was good, but, you know, you really haven't got the ability to tell a story. What you said was, you have, you could. is this fun for you? Because there's also a lot of heartache and exhaustion and frustration. You know, I press the wrong key and the whole bloody computer goes down. I get on the phone and say, I've lost the whole novel. You know, and she said, no, don't panic. There's Google in the corner. So there've been a lot of downs as well as ups when you think, I can't do this, and I can't be bothered doing this. And then the next day, you wake up in the morning and it's like an addiction. It's nagging at you. So this fourth book that we've talked about, I've written and rewritten that 3 times now. And part of me's fed up with it. And the other part of me says, I've put too much work into this. And the two characters, Claire and David, are actually real. I can't leave them there now. Mm. They need to be finished. And I need to be able to say, like Maggie and Greg, their story has been told. So that's, I think it's the addiction that keeps you going, isn't it?
Yeah, so we're almost out of time, but let's just talk about your writing process now, because I think one of your strong points is dialogue, and I wonder how much that is to do with your process. So explain your process.
Okay. I hear voices in my head. I hear my characters talking to each other, and I always take a spiral-bound notebook with me everywhere in my bag and some nice pens. I find some pens that I really like and put them in my bag. So I might be going along and I hear these voices in my head talking about a particular situation. So I write the dialogue, but then I'm not very fast on the computer. I prefer pen. So I have I've got it here to show you. I've got a dictaphone, a Sony top of the range dictaphone. There it is. There are various prices, but this one is the most expensive if anyone is interested. And you plug it straight from the dictaphone into the computer, and it goes via the Dragon software, it goes voice to text. So I'll maybe come back with my spiral bound notebook with here. So that's page 44 of what I was working on yesterday, you know. Mm-hmm. So there's a load of things that I'm writing, then I'll come back and read it into the dictaphone, then immediately plug it into the computer, put it on Dragon, and it comes up on the screen, and then I'll disconnect, and then I'll edit, because often you've repeated something, or so, and I edit it straight away, and then I move it from Dragon into the chapters of where it's going to go. So that's a very strong process for me, because it means I don't have to spend hours typing. I think that I could be sitting here for 4 hours, but I'd get slower and worse as I went along. So I don't allow myself to stay more than an hour and a half sitting down. We've got thrombosis in the family. My auntie had thrombosis. And so I have a kitchen timer, and I put it on for 90 minutes. And then I have my machine that I stand on. It's called a
Redditor. There we go. It's a circulation booster.
It is. And what it does is it vibrates your legs. You put your feet on it and it rocks them back and forward. And it sends, a lot of gyms are doing it now. They wire you up and an electric pulse.
Oh, yeah. It's not quite the same as the gym vibration platform. I've been on one of those. You wouldn't be able to do anything.
No, all right. It's not as strong as that. But you can, I have it at a low level nearly all the time when I'm sitting here. And I've got another one now, which is for my waistline. So I haven't tried that yet. I can say that I've worked on the Revitive probably for 6 months now. And the backs of my legs are not as fat as they were. I have fat calves. And I do think I'm not getting cramp in my legs. So it's important for me not to spend too long here. I have a standing up desk as well. But to be able to get my thoughts onto the computer as fast as possible, then edit, and then spend my time when I'm here actually moving stuff about or editing, as opposed to I don't type.
Yeah, I think that's, and I think that's why your dialogue is so strong, because you're speaking it so much. And I think it's great because that's how you've written all the three books and you're carrying on that way. And it's a great way to learn. What I'd also say, just for everyone, we've used Google Docs because Mum did try Microsoft Word and we did have a few dilemmas with losing things. So in the end, I said, look, let's use Google Docs because a second after you type into Google Docs, it's backed up in the cloud. So even though Mum has felt sometimes she's lost it, I log on because we share all the documents and I can see that it's not lost. So even though you're writing on your own from now on, maybe we'll continue doing that.
I think that'd be a good idea.
Just in case, because, you know, and I know I've had so many emails from people who've lost manuscripts. So having a process where it is backed up in a way is a really good idea.
And the other thing with my handwritten stuff like that, until I've finished the book, I don't throw those notes away. I staple them together and I stick them in a black box in the other room. And plus, it's got loads of photographs. Sometimes part of the process is being able to see the faces of the people that you're writing about. And so I find pictures and stick them in here too. And that helps my process.
And that's so fun. That's really fun as well.
Yeah, I love doing that. And then I keep those. So that if it does disappear off the computer, I can go back and write it again.
You've still got it all. Exactly. No, that's awesome. Okay, so then we have to ask, what is next? So what do you, I mean, we are at the beginning of your next phase. So we're doing this discussion at the end of Penny Appleton. So this might change, but tell us, what are you feeling like you're going to do next? Obviously, you've got the books going. What are you feeling about the name? Tell us, what's next?
I want to finish that book 4, but I'm now going to be doing it through Jay Ryman, who's what we've already got established on Amazon. And I've changed it a bit because Jay Ryman was a funeral celebrant. It's the next 3, and they're going to be 3 sweet romances based around 3 slightly more mature couples. And those people will be on I don't know if people have heard of Saga, which is a travel company for over 55s, I think. Mm. So it's older singles meeting on those kind of holidays, because that often happens. Older singles often meet on those kind of things. So I have every intention of doing at least another 6 books, Joe, but under Jay Ryman.
Fantastic. So Jay Ryman doesn't have a website yet, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to set up a link. So whenever people are watching this or listening to this interview, if you go to thecreativepen.com/mum, spelt with the English spelling of M-U-M, that is going to take you to Mum's books. So basically, they're not out. I mean, you can go to Penny Appleton. At the moment, that link will go to Penny Appleton, but they will eventually go to the Jay Ryman books, and I'll keep that updated.
Ooh, thank you, dear.
Over time, yeah. So you can see Mum's books. So that is fantastic. I'm very excited.
That was a lot of fun. Thank you for asking me.
No, it's been great, and I know everyone will find this really useful, because I think beginning again, maybe let's end on this, because there are some people who are listening who will think that starting again at 68, 70, should you bother? So tell me what, like...
the whole thing about getting dementia is you don't get it if you keep your brain active. So whatever you choose to do when you've finished your standard job, you need to be keeping your mind alive and your body alive. So it doesn't matter if it's writing or it's not, but if you love writing, then design your holidays around your writing. Go to writers' groups. You very kindly, since you're dumping me in the drink now, you've
gently setting you free in the ocean.
I'm wobbling a bit on my bicycle here, Joe, but you have at least enrolled me in a creative fiction writing class, haven't you, for October? So that I'll be with another group of other writers and with another teacher who can read my stuff. Because I think it's jolly hard to edit your own
work. Yeah, you can't edit your own work. No.
Very hard to be able to see it. But why carry on doing it? Well, I'd like to live actively and keep on learning until the moment I leave the planet, really. And this is a great way to do it. I read differently. I watch movies differently. Like, there was a really good documentary on rom-coms on iPlayer couple of nights ago, and I'm sitting there writing notes going, oh my goodness, at the 25%, they've done that. And you look at it and they have indeed. They've brought that particular thing at the 25%. So can I do it in the novel? And would any company like Harlequin like to buy my novels to make them into rom-coms, you know? So it's just a whole exciting world there, isn't there? And you look at books differently when you are writing it. But I suppose it's a bit like playing an instrument. Once you start to learn to play an instrument, you listen differently. You practice your scales, and the same as writing anything. You think, oh, look at that, that's not good. And then you read someone who is writing really well, and it's stunning. And you now know what it took to get to that level of expertise. But it's a journey, isn't it? And when I first thought, I don't want to do this, I don't want to tread on Joe's area. But what you've said to me is we're all on the same journey. We're just at different points along it. So we can share that experience without in any way being in competition.
Yeah, especially as we write in such different genres. So fantastic. Look, that was great, Mum. I know people are going to love it. And if people want to comment on this, I'd suggest people comment on the episode or the Penny at pennyappleton.com email address is fine. Yep. But that's going to be the best way if anyone's got any comments or feedback. So thanks so much, Mum. That was amazing.
Pleasure, Jo. Thank you for having me on your podcast. Bye, everybody.
So I hope you enjoyed the interview with Mum and I today. I certainly have had a real blast with Penny Appleton, and we've both learned a lot. And of course, if you want to check out our sweet romance, you can find Penny Appleton in ebook print and large print on Amazon. We haven't gone wide with it yet. We've only got the three books there. I am going to take it Penny wide shortly. Once that's up, once the period's up on select. Also, if you are interested in Mum's funeral book, which, let's face it, something we've all got to organise at some point, then, and also her new romances will come out under the same name. It's Jay Ryman, J-A-Y-R-Y-M-A-N. So, yeah, very useful funeral book and Penny Appleton's sweet romance. Okay, and next week I'm talking about global publishing with Kinga Gentetics from Publish Drive. And I have recently published all my books on Publish Drive, primarily for Google Play, but also to get onto China's Dangdang platform and all the other platforms they distribute to. So really, and Kinga is from Hungary, so I'm really looking forward to bringing her global perspective to you next week. So have a wonderful writing week, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.